Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in Matzot, Maaseh, which is Numbers chapter 30. We're going to end that book. We'll go on to Deuteronomy the following week. There's lots and lots of reading and bunch of names that I will mispronounce horribly. So, Numbers chapter 30. Yes. Oh, hands up. He got the names? Yeah, that'd be fair. But have him overdub me the names. Okay, well, we'll go with this. So Numbers chapter 30, mine starts verse 2. I'm not sure what your voice is. Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes, the children of Israel, saying, "This is the thing the Lord has commanded. If a man takes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to establish a prohibition upon himself, he shall not desecrate his word. According to whatever comes from his mouth, he shall do. But if a woman will take a vow to the Lord or establish a prohibition in her father's home in her youth, and her father heard her vow or her prohibition that she established upon herself, and her father was silent about her, then all her vows will stand. Any prohibition she has established upon herself shall stand. But if her father restrained her on the day of his hearing, all her vows and prohibitions that she established upon herself shall not stand. The Lord will forgive her, for her father had restrained her. If she shall be married to a man and her vows were upon her, or an utterance of her lips by which she had prohibited something upon herself, and her husband heard, and on the day of his hearing he was silent about her, then her vows shall stand, and her prohibition that she established upon herself shall stand. But if on the day of her husband's hearing he shall restrain her, he shall revoke the vow that is upon her, or the utterance of her lips by which she had prohibited something upon herself, then the Lord will forgive her. The vow of a widow or a divorcee, anything she had prohibited upon herself, shall remain upon her. But if she vowed in her husband's home, or she established a prohibition upon herself through an oath, and her husband heard and was silent about her, he did not restrain her, then all her vows shall stand. Any prohibition she established upon herself shall stand. But if her husband shall revoke them on the day of his hearing, anything that came out of her mouth regarding her oaths or the prohibition upon herself shall not stand. Her husband shall have revoked them, and the Lord will forgive her. Any vow and any oath prohibition to cause personal affliction, her husband may let stand, and her husband may revoke. If her husband shall be silent about her from day to day, he will have let stand all her vows or all the prohibitions that are upon her. He will have let them stand, for he was silent about her on the day of his hearing. But if he shall revoke them after his having heard, he shall bear her iniquity. These are the decrees the Lord commanded Moses between a man and his wife, between a father and his daughter in her youth, in her father's house. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take vengeance, the children of Israel, against the Midianites. Afterward you will be gathered unto your people." Moses spoke to the people, saying, "Arm men from among yourselves for the legion, that they may be against Midian, to inflict the Lord's vengeance against Midian. 1,000 from a tribe, 1,000 from a tribe, for all the tribes of Israel shall you send to the legion." So there were delivered for the thousands of the children of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for the legion. Moses sent them, 1,000 from each tribe, for the legion, them and Phinehas, son of Eleazar the Cohen, to the legion, and the sacred vessels and the trumpets for sounding in his hand. They massed against Midian, as the Lord had commanded Moses, and they killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian, along with their slain ones, Evi, Rakin, Zur, Hur, Reba, the five kings of Midian, and Balaam, son of Beor, they slew with the sword. The children of Israel took captive the women of Midian, and the young children, and all their cattle and flocks, and their wealth they took as spoils. All the cities of their habitations, and all their palaces they burned in fire. They took all the booty and the captives, the people, and the animals. They brought to Moses, to Eleazar the Cohen, and the assembly of the children of Israel, the captives, the animals and the booty of the camp at the plains of Moab, which was by the Jordan near Jericho. Moses, Eleazar the Cohen, and all the leaders of the assembly went out to meet them outside the camp. Moses was angry with the commanders of the army, the officers of the thousands and the officers of the hundreds who came from the legion in the battle. Moses said to them, "Did you let every female live? Behold, it was they who caused Israel by the word of Balaam to commit a betrayal against the Lord regarding the matter of Peor and the plague that occurred in the assembly of the Lord. Now, kill every male among the children, and every woman fit to know a man by lying with a male. You shall kill. But all the young children among the women who have not known lying with a man, you may keep alive for yourselves. And as for you, encamp outside the camp for a period of 7 days. Whoever killed a person or touched a corpse shall purify yourselves on the third day and on the seventh day. You and your captives, every garment, every vessel of hide, everything that made from that comes from goats, every vessel of wood, you shall purify." Eleazar the Cohen said to the men of the legion who came to the battle, "This is the decree of the law, which the Lord commanded Moses. Only the gold and the silver and the copper, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that it comes into the fire, you shall pass through the fire, and it will be purified. But it must be purified with the water of sprinkling. And everything that would not come in the fire, you shall pass through the water. You shall immerse your garments on the seventh day and become purified. Afterward, you may enter the camp." The Lord said to Moses, saying, "Calculate the total of the captured spoils of the people and animals. You, Eleazar the Cohen, and the heads, the fathers of the assembly, divide the spoils in half between those who undertook the battle to go out to legion and the entire assembly. You shall raise up a tribute to the Lord from the men of war who go out to the legion. One living being of 500 for the people, from the cattle, for the donkeys, and from the flock. You shall take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the Cohen as a portion to the Lord. And from the half of the children of Israel, you shall take draw one from 50 from the people, from the cattle, the donkeys, the flocks, from all the animals. You shall give them to the Levites, the guardians of the charge of the Lord's tabernacle." Moses and Eleazar the Cohen did as the Lord commanded Moses. The animal booty beyond the spoils the people of the legion looted, the flock 675,000, and cattle 72,000, donkeys 61,000, human beings, the women who had not known lying with the male, all the souls 32,000. The half, which was the share of those who went out of the legion, was the count of flock, 337,500. The tribute of the Lord for the flock was 675. The cattle, 36,000, and their tribute to the Lord was 72. The donkeys, 30,500. The tribute to the Lord was 61. And the human beings, 16,000. Their tribute to the Lord was 32 people. Moses gave the tribute that was raised up to the Lord to Eleazar the Cohen, as the Lord had commanded Moses. From half the children of Israel that Moses divided from the men of legions, half the assembly was of the flock was 337,500, the cattle 36,000, the donkeys 30,500, the human beings 16,000. Moses took from the half the children of Israel one drawn from the 50, and the people, the animals, and he gave to them to Levites, the guardians of the charge of the Lord's tabernacle, as the Lord had commanded Moses. The commanders of the thousands of legions, the officers of the thousands, the officers of hundreds, approached Moses. They said to Moses, "Your servants took a census of the men of war under our command. Not a single man is missing. So we have brought an offering to the Lord. What any man found of gold, anklet, bracelet, ring, earring, clasp, to atone for our souls with the Lord." Moses and Eleazar the Cohen took the gold from them, fashioned vessels, every fashioned vessel. All the gold was raised up, which set apart for the Lord, was 16,750 shekels. From the officers of the thousands, the officers of the hundreds. As the men of the legion, each man looted for himself. Moses and Eleazar the Kohen took the gold from the officers and the thousands and the hundreds and brought it to the tent of meeting, a remembrance for the children of Israel before the Lord. Chapter 32. The children of Reuben, the children of Gad, had abundant livestock, very great. They saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, and behold, the place was a place for livestock. The children of Gad, the children of Reuben, came to and said to Moses, to Eleazar the Kohen, and to the leaders of the assembly, saying, Atrot, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Eliah, Sabam, and Nebu, and beyond. The land the Lord smote for the assembly of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. They said, if we have found favor in your eyes, let this land be given to your servants as a heritage. Do not bring us across the Jordan. Moses said to the children of Gad, the children of Reuben, should your brothers go out to battle while you settle here? Why do you dissuade the heart of the children of Israel from crossing the land the Lord has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. They went to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land. They dissuaded the heart of the children of Israel not to come to land the Lord had given them. The wrath of the Lord burned on that day, and he swore, saying, these men who came up from Egypt from the age of 20 years and above will see the ground that I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, for they have not followed me fully. Except for Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, son of Nun, for they followed the Lord fully. The wrath of the Lord burned against Israel, and he made them wander the wilderness for 40 years, to the end the entire generation that did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Behold, you have risen up in place of your fathers, a society of sinful people, to add more to the burning wrath of the Lord against Israel. For if you will turn away from after him, he will again let it rest in the wilderness, and you will destroy this entire people. They approached him, saying, pens for the livestock flock we shall build here, for our livestock and cities for our small children. We shall arm ourselves swiftly in the vanguard of the children of Israel until we have brought them to their place, and our small children will dwell in the fortified cities before the inhabitants of the land. We shall not return to our homes until the children of Israel will have inherited every man his inheritance. For we shall not inherit with them across the Jordan and beyond. For our inheritance has come to us on the east bank of the Jordan. Verse 20 now, chapter 32. Moses said to them, if you do this thing, if you arm yourselves before the Lord for battle, and every armed man among you shall cross the Jordan before the Lord, until he drives out his enemies from him, and the land shall be conquered before the Lord, and then you shall return. Then you shall be vindicated from the Lord and from Israel, and this land shall be a heritage for you before the Lord. But if you do not do so, behold, you will have sinned, the Lord. Know your sin that will encounter you. Build for yourselves cities for your small children and pens for your livestock. And what has come from your mouth you shall do. The children of Gad, the children of Reuben, said to Moses, saying, your servants shall do as our Lord commands. Our small children, our wives, our livestock, and our animals will be there in the cities of Gilead. And your servants shall cross over, every armed person of the legion, before the Lord to do battle as the Lord speaks. Concerning them, Moses commanded Eleazar the Kohen, Joshua son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of Israel. Moses said to them, if the children of Gad and the children of Reuben will cross the Jordan with you, everyone armed for battle before the Lord, and the land is conquered before you, you shall give them the land of Gilead as a heritage. But if they do not cross over, armed with you, then they will take their heritage among you in the land of Canaan. The children of Gad, the children of Reuben, spoke up, saying, as the Lord has spoken to your servants, so shall we do. We shall cross over armed before the Lord to the land of Canaan, and ours shall be the heritage of our inheritance across the Jordan. So Moses gave to them, the children of Gad, the children of Reuben, and half the tribe of Manasseh, son of Joseph, the kingdom of Sheon, king of the Amorite, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, the land with its cities and boundaries, and cities of the surrounding land. The children of Gad built Dibon, and Atarot, and Aor, and Roth Sophon, and Jazir, and Jokbeha, and Beth Nimra, and Beth Haran, fortified cities and pens for their flocks. The children of Reuben built Heshbon, and Eliah, and Kirathiam, and Nebo, and Baalmeon, with altered names, and Sibda, and they called them by other names instead of the names of the cities they built. The children of Machir, son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and captured it, and drove out the Amorites who were in it. Moses gave the Gilead to Machir, son of Manasseh, and he settled in it. Jair, son of Manasseh, went and captured their villages, and called them Havot Jair. Noba went and captured Kanat and her suburbs, and called it Noba, after his own name. Next parasha is Maaseh, chapter 33. These the journeys, the children of Israel, who went from the land of Egypt to quarter their legions, under the hand of Moses and Aaron. Moses wrote their goings forth according to their journeys at the bidding of the Lord. These were their journeys according to their goings forth. They journeyed from Ramses, the first month, the 15th day of the first month, on the day after the Pesach offering. The children of Israel went forth with an upraised hand before the eyes of all of Egypt. And the Egyptians were burying those among them who the Lord had struck, every firstborn, and on their gods the Lord had inflicted punishments. The children of Israel journeyed from Ramses and encamped at Sukkot. They journeyed from Sukkot and encamped at Etam, which is on the edge of the wilderness. They journeyed from Etam and turned back to Pi Hahiroth, which is before Baal Zephon, and they encamped before Migdol. They journeyed from before Hahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea toward the wilderness. They went on a 3-day trip in the wilderness of Etam, and they encamped in Mara. They journeyed from Mara and arrived at Elim. In Elim were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they encamped there. They journeyed from Elim and encamped by the Sea of Reeds. They journeyed from the Sea of Reeds and encamped in the wilderness of Sin. They journeyed from the wilderness of Sin and encamped at Dofka. They journeyed from Dofka and encamped at Elush. They journeyed from Elush and encamped in Rephidim. There was no water there for the people to drink. They journeyed from Rephidim and encamped in the wilderness of Sinai. They journeyed from the wilderness of Sinai and encamped at Kibrot Hatava. They journeyed from Kibrot Hatava and encamped in Hazrot. They journeyed from Hazrot and encamped in Ritma. They journeyed from Ritma and encamped in Ramon Perez. They journeyed from Ramon Perez and encamped in Libna. They journeyed from Libna and encamped in Risa. They journeyed from Risa and encamped in Kehalata. Excuse me. They journeyed from Kehalata and encamped at Mount Sephir. They journeyed from Mount Sephir and encamped in Haradah. They journeyed from Haradah and encamped in Mecholot. They journeyed from Mecholot and encamped in Tahat. They journeyed from Tahat and encamped in Terah. They journeyed from Terah and encamped in Mitka. They journeyed from Mitka and encamped in Hashmona. They journeyed from Hashmona and encamped in Moserot. They journeyed from Moserot and encamped in Bnei Jachon. They journeyed from Bnei Jachon and encamped in Hor Hagadigad. They journeyed from Hor Hagadigad and encamped at Jotbatha. They journeyed from Jotbatha and encamped at Abrona. They journeyed from Abrona and encamped in Ezion Geber. They journeyed from Ezion Geber and encamped in the wilderness of Zin, which is Kadesh. They journeyed from the Kadesh and encamped in Mount Hor, at the edge of the land of Edom. Then Aaron the Kohen went up to Mount Hor at the word of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the children of Israel went forth to the land of Egypt, in the 5th month on the 1st of the month. Aaron was 123 years old at his death on Mount Hor. The Canaanite king of Arad heard, and he was dwelling in the south, in the land of Canaan, of the approach of the children of Israel. They journeyed from Mount Hor and encamped at Zalmona. They journeyed from Zalmona and encamped at Punon. They journeyed from Punon and encamped at Obot. They journeyed from Oboth and encamped in the ruins of the passes at the border of Moab. They journeyed from the ruins and encamped at Dibon Gad. They journeyed from Dibon Gad and encamped in Almon Diblath Amah. They journeyed from Almon Diblath Amah and encamped in the mountains of the passes before Nebo. They journeyed from the mountains, the passes, and encamped in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. They encamped by the Jordan from Beth Jemoth until the plains of Shittim in the plains of Moab. The Lord spoke to Moses the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan to the land of Canaan, you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. You shall destroy all their prostration stones. All their molten images shall you destroy. All their high places shall you demolish. You shall possess the land, and you shall settle in it. For to you have I given the land to possess it. You shall give the land as an inheritance by lot to your families. To the many you shall increase its inheritance, and to the few you shall decrease its inheritance. Wherever its lot shall fall, this as shall be. According to the tribes your fathers shall you inherit. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land before you, those of them who you leave shall be pins in your eyes, and a surrounding barrier of thorns in your sides. And they will harass you upon the land in which you dwell. It shall be that what I meant to do to them, I shall do to you." 34. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the children of Israel, say to them, when you come to the land of Canaan, this is the land that you shall fall to you as inheritance, the land of Canaan according to its borders. Your southern side shall be for the wilderness of Zin at the side of Edom, and your southern border shall be for the edge of the Salt Sea to the east. The border shall go around south Amale-Akrabim and shall pass towards Zin, and its outskirts shall be south of Kadesh Barnea. Then it shall go out to Hazar Adar and pass to Asmon. The border shall go around from Asmon, the stream of Egypt, and its outskirts shall be toward the sea. The western border, it shall be for you the great sea, and the district, this shall be for you the western border. This shall be for you the northern border from the great sea, shall you turn to Mount Hor. From Mount Hor you shall turn to the approach to Hamath, and the outskirts of the border shall be toward Zedad. The border shall go forth towards Ziphon, and its outskirts shall be Hazar Enan. This shall be for you the northern border. You shall draw yourselves as the eastern border from Hazar Enan to Shepham. The border shall descend from Shepham to Riblah, east of Ain. The border shall descend and extend to the bank of the Kinneret Sea to the east. The border shall descend to the Jordan, and its outskirts shall be the Salt Sea. This shall be the land for you, according to its borders all around. Moses commanded the children of Israel, saying, "This is the land you shall divide as an inheritance by lot, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9.5 tribes. For the tribe of the children of Reuben have taken according to their father's house, and the tribe of the children of Gad according to their father's house, and half the tribe of Manasseh have taken their inheritance. 2.5 tribes have taken their inheritance on the bank of the Jordan by Jericho, eastward toward the sunrise." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "These are the names of the men who are to take possession of the land for you. Elzar the Kohen, and Joshua son of Nun, and one leader from each tribe shall you take to possess the land. These are the names of the men of the tribe of Judah: Caleb, son of Jephunneh; the tribe of Simeon, Shemuel, son of Amihud; the tribe of Benjamin, Elidad, son of Kishon; the tribe of children of Dan, as leader Buki, son of Jogli; the children of Joseph, the tribe of the children of Manasseh, its leader Haniel, son of Ephod; the tribe of the children of Ephraim, as leader Kemuel, son of Shiftan; the tribe of the children of Zebulun, as leader Elsaphan, son of Parnach; the tribe of the children of Issachar, as leader Patiel, son of Azan; the tribe of the children of Asher, as leader Ahihud, son of Shilomi; the tribe of the children of Naphtali, as leader Pedahiel, son of Amihud. These are the ones whom the Lord commanded to approach the children of Israel in the land of Canaan. 35. The Lord spoke to Moses, the plains of Moab by the Jordan, at Jericho, saying, command the children of Israel, they shall give to Levites from their inheritance a possession, cities for dwelling. And the open space for the cities all around them shall you give to Levites. The cities shall be theirs for dwelling, and their open space shall be their animals, and for their wealth, and for all their needs. The open space and city that you shall give to Levites, from the wall of the city outward, 1,000 cubits all around. You shall measure from the outside of the city on the eastern side 2,000 cubits, on the southern side 2,000 cubits, on the western side 2,000 cubits, northern side 2,000 cubits, with the city in the middle. This shall be for them the open spaces of the cities. The cities you shall give to the Levites as 6 cities of refuge you shall provide as for a murderer to flee there. And in addition to them, you shall give them 42 cities. All the cities that you shall give Levites is 48 cities. From them and their open spaces, the cities that you shall give them from the possession of the children of Israel, from the many you shall increase, from the few you shall decrease. Each according to his inheritance, that they shall inherit, shall he give of his cities to Levites. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when you cross the Jordan to the land of Canaan, you shall designate cities for yourselves. Cities of refuge shall they be for you. A killer shall flee there, one who takes a life unintentionally. The city shall be for you a refuge from the avenger. So the killer will not die until he stands before the assembly for judgment. As the cities you shall designate, there shall be 6 cities of refuge. 3 cities you designate on the other side of the Jordan, and 3 cities you designate on the land of Canaan. They shall be cities of refuge. The children of Israel and the proselyte and the resident above them shall these 6 cities be a refuge for anyone who kills a person unintentionally to flee there. If he had struck him with an iron implement and he died, he is a killer. The killer shall surely be put to death. Or if with a hand-sized stone of which one could die, and he did strike him and he died, he is a killer. The killer shall surely be put to death. If he struck him with a hand-sized wood implement, which one could die, and he died, he's a killer. The killer should be put to death. The avenger of blood, he shall put the killer to death when he encounters him. He shall put him to death. If he pushed him out of hatred or hurled upon him from ambush, and he died, for an enemy struck him with his hand, and he died, the assailant shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall kill the murderer when he encounters him. But if with suddenness, without enmity, he did push him, or he hurled any implement upon him without ambush, or with any stone through which one could die without having seen and caused to fall upon him and he died, who is not his enemy, does not seek his harm, the assembly shall judge between the assailant and the avenger of blood, according to these laws. The assembly shall rescue the murderer from the hand of the avenger of the blood. This shall return him to his city of refuge, where he had fled. He shall dwell in it until the death of Kohen Gadol, whom one had anointed with the sacred oil. But if the murderer will ever leave the border of the city of refuge, which he had fled, the avenger of blood shall find him outside the city, outside the border of his city of refuge. The avenger of blood will kill the murderer. He has no blood guilt. For he must dwell in his city of refuge until the death of Kohen Gadol. And after the death of the Kohen Gadol, the murderer shall return to the land of his possession. These shall be for you a decree of justice for your generations, in all your dwelling places. Whoever smites a person according to the testimony of a witness shall one kill the murderer. But a single witness shall not testify against a person regarding death. You shall not accept ransom for the life of a murderer who is worthy of death, for he shall surely be put to death. You shall not accept ransom for one who fled to a city of refuge to return to dwell in the land before the death of the Kohen. You shall not bring guilt upon the land in which you are, for the blood will bring guilt upon the land. The land will not have atonement for the blood that was spilled in it, except the blood of the one who spilled it. You shall not contaminate the land in which you dwell, in whose midst I rest. For I am the Lord who rests among the children of Israel. 36. The heads of the fathers of the family of the children of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, of the families of the children of Joseph, approached and spoke before Moses, before the leaders, the heads of the fathers of the children of Israel. Said, the Lord has commanded my master to give the land as an inheritance by law to the children of Israel. And my master has been commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. If they become wives of one of the sons, tribes of the children of Israel, then their inheritance will be subtracted from the inheritance of our fathers, and be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. It will be subtracted from the lot of our inheritance. When the Jubilee will arrive, the children of Israel, their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they will marry. From the inheritance of the tribe of their fathers, of our fathers, will their inheritance be subtracted. Moses commanded the children of Israel, according to the word of the Lord, saying, correctly does the tribe of the children of Joseph speak. This is the word of the Lord has commanded regarding the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them be wives to whomever is good in their eyes, but only to the family of their father's tribe shall they become wives. An inheritance of the children of Israel shall not make rounds from tribe to tribe. Rather, the children of Israel shall cleave every man to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. Every daughter who inherits an inheritance of the tribe to the children of Israel shall become the wife of someone from the family of her father's tribe. So that everyone in the children of Israel will inherit the inheritance of his fathers. An inheritance shall not make rounds from tribe to the tribe. The tribes of Israel shall cleave every man to his own inheritance. As the Lord commanded Moses, so did the daughters of Zelophehad do. Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, became wives to sons of their uncles, to cousins, from the families of the children of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, did they become wives, and their inheritance remained with the tribe and the family of their father. These the commandments, the ordinances, the Lord commanded through Moses, the children of Israel, the plains of Moab, at the Jordan, by Jericho. That's a lot of reading. Thank you. Those names are hard. Oh, there's a few questions. Go ahead, Dan, go first.
Oh, sorry. Okay, now, if the mother does... Okay, in the beginning when we were talking about when a woman makes a vow...
A vow.
Now, if there's no father in the house, can the mother disavow the vow, or does she have to run to the priest to have him do it?
We'll discuss that, actually. That's an interesting point. Judaism came up with that problem. So, okay, and they probably said, what do we do about this situation? And when people make a vow unintentionally, without full knowledge, understanding what they're doing, they sometimes make vows without having all the information that we're supposed to have to actually know what we're doing. Or we make a vow that's harmful to ourselves or to our family, we didn't know it. So, well, how do you deal with these mistaken vows, these screw-ups, these oopses, that if you carry them out, will cause more harm than good? They came with solutions, and they had determined there were two options for someone to do this. In the case, for example, a woman who made a mistake, widow, she should stick with her vow, but the vow was done by error. Someone tricked her, manipulation, lack of information. How does she deal with this problem? They also dealt with boys whose fathers aren't around. They're orphan sons who make mistakes. Their dad doesn't say, hey, you can't do that. How do you handle this? There are two options they decided. They said, all right, first option, the principle behind having a father or a husband above you, the idea is that someone must be aware of or fully cognizant of all the details of what's happening to say yes or no. They determined that a head of a tribe should be that type of person for these individuals. So if you have a problem, a widow or divorcee makes a mistaken vow, these are not vows that are without mistake, these vows with mistakes, screw-up ones, that should never have been done because lack of knowledge. This does not account to someone who does have full knowledge, woman or male or female, and makes a vow. If they got full knowledge, had all the information, made the vow anyway, they're stuck with it. But if they didn't have the full information, didn't know everything was going on, they made a mistake, lack of knowledge, how do you get out of the lack of knowledge problem? They say, okay, the head of a tribe is like a father figure to the whole tribe. They should pretend he is like your dad. In that respect, for those narrow few instances. When it comes to sons, who are orphans, no dad around, they're too young, or their boys would make vows. It didn't say sons, it just said, it was talking about daughters chapter alone. In terms of the same type of scenario should happen. It should be the parent or the overall, the patriarch of that particular family clan, is that he is a default father, or a default husband, or default person in charge. If one doesn't exist, you can't find one. There's no one around, no default parents, they're all dead, whatever, they're all gone. And a vow happens by mistake. The second option that Judaism produced, the rabbis produced, said, make a trial of three adult males who are fully aware. Who may not be your direct parent or knowledge, but the three adult males who can say, okay, here are all the facts. What was your vow? What was your oath? What happened? What's the problem with this? And they can overrule it as a vote of three to overrule it and or absolve the situation. Those are only based on vows and oaths done in error. You made a mistake. You had lack of knowledge. Doesn't apply to ones you had full knowledge of, that you purposefully made. We'll discuss more details what vows and oaths mean, because they are different things from each other. You can make one and not the other, and vice versa. Yes, Daniel.
So this is a kind of a two-parter, and it sounds like you might be discussing it later, but were these vows public vows, personal, private vows? And could you possibly give some examples of the types of vows that these people might have been making?
I will give a couple examples of types of vows they made. Most of these vows, the intent is to make them public. The reason is, you pay for vows. Vows are a paid item. It is an animal you have to sacrifice when you've completed the vow, or a dollar amount you give when you've completed the vow. Vows and oaths are supposed to be public enough to where a priest or somebody who is aware of it can verify, yes, you fulfilled your vow, here is the payment for it, you are now free of your vows. It has to be public enough to make that happen. As opposed to an internal private one you do inside your head, those don't count. They don't mean anything because it's all inside your head. No one has any knowledge of it. It's been you and God. And we do that all the time. Well, I'll never do that again. Problem is, and then 6 months later, oops, you did it again. We do it our own heads. We make vows like that to ourselves. Or actually, that's technically not a vow. That's an oath of what I won't do again. But we do it ourselves, and we break them all the time. But those are ones you do internally, which this is not discussing internal vows. These are spoken, I am XYZ doing this or not going to do that, whatever it may be. Here's my completion date or my time cycle or what condition is my vow is completed. And you've made a full formal statement to at least one or to prefer two people who have heard it. And the priest can then verify you did these things. Does that make sense? So, say it again. An example. Most vows are done through, most of vows. There's a difference between vow and oath. There's two different examples. Let me write them down for you. There's a vow and oath. These are not the same things. So a vow, excuse me, is defined as a permitted thing. So, for example, you can create a law upon yourself, whether it's permitted or not permitted. So a vow is like you have built or created a law for you. A law that contains a punishment for breaking the vow. So the law has to have a punishment to go with it. It also has to have a completion. So you have completed the vow, the law. Now the law is a permissible item or what is not against the Torah. So a permissible thing. Say, for example, you make a vow that, gluten-free. It's common today, right? So you make a law that I will not eat gluten again. And you say, if I do, I will pay some dollar amount in my gluten-free... People do this for cigarette smoking, too. I won't smoke again. Anytime I smoke a cigarette, here's a dollar in this pot that I have to give to somebody. It's something like that. That is a vow with a law and a punch that goes with it. So there's eating gluten or smoking. Those are objects that you say, these objects, these items are forbidden from me. Actually, more specifically, the vows are designed for objects, things which are normally permitted, you are purposely not permitting yourself. Or things that are unpermitted. Well, actually, it's never unpermitted. It is unpermitted against the Torah. But things that are permitted for a certain class of people, you are going to put yourself temporarily in that same class to make it also applied to you. So this clause, I'm going to erase this one. This would apply to, for example, the Nazirite vow is an example, a good example of this. The Nazirite vow essentially is a long hair, no grapes, no grape products, right? And you work at the temple. Well, are grapes illegal? No. Is wine illegal? No. Are grape products illegal? No. Is long hair a problem? Can't you be short? Those are not, those things are illegal, but you've temporarily placed yourself inside this category where you're going to maintain these things for a period of time, 6 months, a year, your whole lifetime, in case of Samson, whatever it may be, before it finally ends. So those are all vow items. So these are all examples of vow type things that you can do. It is dominant around objects or things that apply to you. You can also make a vow as a priest as well to serve the priesthood for a period of time or for a given time slot or for a given lifespan, whatever it may be. So we have a hand up. Who was it?
Oh. That's the same as
yes, so the contract now. An oath is different. Now, vows are one thing. We have oaths. Mind you, I should be more careful. This vow, this is not the English definition of vow. This is what the Hebrew Bible defines what the vow is. We're translating as the word vow for English. The actual word is nadar. That's a Hebrew word. Nadar, actually. Nadar. That's the actual word. So this definition, I should be more careful, it's actually the definition of a nadir. Our English translates the word nadir as vow, which is the closest thing we could figure out that would be kind of similar to it. Because in English, we use the term vow for objects or for actions. It makes no difference. Well, in Judaism, those are two completely different things. An object is a vow, an action is an oath, which is a different word. We translate it as oath. And that's a shibah. He refers to Sheba, which is an oath. Yes, it's a behavior. I will act this way. I will respond in this manner. It is an action-based oath. It's an action-based. So oath is actions. Has to do with how you will act towards someone or something. This is if inside you, inside your own personal head, your emotional state, all that combined gobbledygook. So actions. This is what you will do. Do or act. So when we have, for example, our wedding vows that we put, I will love you forever and blah, blah, blah. Those are all oaths because they are action-based. Now, if you know, if you have a Hebrew contract, the ketubah contains both oaths and vows. They're actually, they contain them both inside of ketubah. Ketubah says, here are how I will act. And in this list, there's a paragraph that here's what I will do to you if I don't. Here's my punishment, my corrections, my payment that goes to you. How I will care for you all your days, even if I divorce you. Those type of things, that's within the ketubah's contract. So in Judaism, they combine both the Dara and Sheba together inside of a wedding event. It's both action, things that cause punishment, and things you will physically do, as well as things that belong to you, and as payment if I screw up. Yes.
A covenant, or the covenant, was both.
Yes, a covenant contains both items. A covenant contains both a promise object or a fulfillment. You fulfilled it up to, here is your reward for completing the covenant contract. And an oath, or the Sheba in a covenant, will also say, here's what I will do to make this all happen. So a covenant is a combination of both items into a single thing. Does it make sense? Okay. Yes, God made covenant. The covenant that God made was he said he will have actions, what he will do, and it lists what we will do, both. And the promises was, well, it wasn't so much a law. The laws were implied in it as well. There were actually gifts or items when you received. In the case of his covenant, you had life as a benefit, or when the completion of the covenant is done, of course, it definitely completes. You also have the kingdom of God, which are things. These are objects. That's where the vow came in, or the nidar came in. But what he will do, care for you, make sure you survive, continue on the seed forever and ever and ever. That's how God's going to take care of action-wise. And our response, what we must do, is based on our actions. How will we treat God? How will we respond to Him? So it's the covenant is a combination of both things, but we are perishable items. We die. We can't promise God, oh, in thousand generations from now, I will do X, Y, Z for you. Yeah, good luck with that. Yeah, not going to happen, right? So we can't do anything for Him. We can praise Him, but we can actually physically do things. He does all the doing. All we can do is how we act toward Him, our responses to Him, how we conduct ourselves to what God does. That's an oath upon our end, but it's a covenant on His end. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions or comments?
Okay, now, when somebody accidentally murders somebody, now the other family member is going to want to kill them, but how come they can go away when the priest dies? What if the guy still wants to kill him?
Not permitted to.
That could, oh, he's not murder. Allowed to?
He's murdered then.
Okay.
So in the case of a murderer, oh, let's actually erase that. That's from 2 weeks ago, right? Well, I'll just draw it over here. So the case of the murderer, the accidental deaths. Now, the accidental deaths, to be an accidental death has to be ruled an accident or unintentional. You can't say, it was an accident to walk away. No, judge has to, okay, was it really? There's a trial, witnesses, blah, blah, blah. And by you, this is regarding death penalty cases. So this isn't like, oh, so-and-so stole such and such from me. We're not doing that. This is murder. This is murder. So death. Death by unintentional or accident. In this case, if the trial hasn't taken place yet, and the person's wandering around the city, or outside the city, or wherever. Now, mind you, there's no police force here. There's no justice system. None of that exists. They assume every human being has the knowledge of what is right and wrong defined in the Torah. All humans are built that way. Well, they're given that's a default assumption. So any avenger of death, which is the police, who have to do the same thing. We call them, you know, jailers and executioners when they quit the trial. Somebody has to go to death row, blah, blah, blah. They have assigned people, which we pay people to do that today. But at the time, that didn't exist. Families were assigned to do this work. When something went wrong, a family's task was to go address and fix the problem or pay or make whoever did it pay for it. So avenger of death's job is to go avenge or pay for the blood that was spilled. This is not a vigilante. This is a pay for the blood that was spilled. So-and-so, your cousin, your uncle, your brother, whatever, was murdered, as far as you're concerned, because no one can prove otherwise. Blood's on the ground. God said that blood contaminates the ground. That is part of my inheritance, part of the person who died dead, their inheritance, their children. This ground is now contaminated with their blood. To pay for that, the person who killed them has to die. So it is obligation by the avenger to go pay for the blood of the relative who was just killed. Else we were ignoring it, and you then pollute the land, and God said, you pollute the land, I'll get rid of you. So you have to make sure when murders happen, they are taken care of properly, not ignored or neglected. Make sense? So that's his job. Now, in the case of an accident, the person obviously runs to the city refuge. They'll go there anyway, even if it was on purpose, murder or otherwise. The point is, go to city refuge. The point is, wait for a trial. A murderer who is truly a murderer and knows that the trial is not going to go in his favor probably won't stay in the city refuge. He'll probably just take off and skip town and disappear. Or go murder other people. Who knows? He's a murderer. He's a serial killer. We're not dealing with those. So, accidental death. He goes to city of refuge. Which there's six of them. There's on both sides of Jordan. The map, well, I'll get that in a minute on the map. City of refuge. He has to wait there until his trial happens. When his trial occurs, he determined, yes, it was an accident, it was not done intentionally. Whatever reason, we have witnesses, blah, blah, blah. The person is then set free. Inside the city of refuge. They have to live there until the high priest dies. Now, if the high priest is a young man, you're going to live there a long time. If the high priest is an old man, you may luck out. Who knows? It's depending on how old you are. You may die first anyway. But you stay there until the high priest passes, and then when that's done, if the avenger comes across you and you're in the field and the high priest has died, If the avenger kills you, he is a murderer, premeditated murderer. This is not an accidental murderer. He's not, oh, well, it's forgiven. No, no, no. You premeditated. You waited in ambush. You fed across. You desired to kill him. You did so, and it was a murder, not a murder. The avenger death doesn't get the nice, quick trial that says, oh, well, it wasn't an accident. It's a, wait a minute. You were assigned the avenger of death duty by your family. We have document that says so. By the way, avenger of death is a documentation that says, I am the avenger of death. I am not just any random person of the family. I have to be assigned or given this task. And document that's who it is. So this person finds them, and they're out of the city, and the high priest has died. They were a murderer if they kill him. Then they have to go to the city, get a trial, and they'll be executed, because it's obvious they killed him. I don't think there's many instances of this actually happening in the Torah, in the Bible anywhere, but the point is that that's the idea behind it.
Well, I just questioned that because, you know, I didn't know that they were trying to be. So everybody would know who's who as far as the avengers of the families.
Right.
So I didn't realize that. You didn't tell us that before.
Right. So yeah, it's not just any person or relative. It is the avenger that's been elected by that family. It has to be a family member to do this particular murder. Now, what if there are two murderers or two accidents happen? Well, the avenger might get elected to both, but usually not. He's assigned this one he must take care of, whichever city refuge there is. If that one happens, I consider moving. You're living in a dangerous area. But you might get another avenger assigned to that guy. Who knows? I don't know what the details are. So you could have the same person doing both or doing two different avengers at both times. But they must be assigned. It's not a random relative. Hey, I happened on this guy. I knew who it was, so I killed him. It doesn't work that way. Unless you were assigned, it is considered a murder on your part. Make sense? Okay. Any questions? Yes. Oh, hold on. This side over here. Oh, go ahead.
So, Moses had to go back and kill his in-laws?
Moses had to go back and kill his in-laws.
God told him to destroy all the Midianites.
Midianites. In a manner of speaking, yes. We'll have to discuss that briefly. Hold on, because that's a bigger detail. Yes, go ahead, Larry.
What's the authority for what you just explained about it? Is that in the scriptures?
Oh, the avenger of death, or the assignment person.
That
the assignment person. The avenger of death is in the Torah a specific person. A person is given that. That's what we discussed. The avenger of death. You were assigned it. The avenger of death for that murder. That's the Torah. But as far as how it worked, whether one person can be assigned to two different murders or two different people are assigned, that's not. Oh, right. Well, actually, the rabbis discussed this precise topic. They discussed about, okay, how do you know the one is an avenger, not just a random person on the side of the street who said, well, I decided I was the avenger today. Well, it was yesterday, so-and-so, but now it's today. They determined that, no, you can't just assign yourself. You have to be assigned. Well, to be assigned, somebody has to assign you. And who's that person to assign you? Must be the family member who did it. Well, usually it would be the parent or the patriarch of the tribe or somebody who had to give you this task to go do. And for them to do that, you either have to have documentation or a record or witnesses that says this is what happened. At least, because you're dealing with murder, you have to have two witnesses. So the evidence indicates this person was assigned the avengers. They were discussing this topic of how the avenger would be assigned and what they would do. So they determined that some kind of a witness or documentation has to go with this individual, or people have to be aware of he is the permanent avenger for the family anytime something goes wrong. Somehow they are assigned. In the case for, case for David, and when he assigned it to Solomon for, I think his name was Sheba, I think the guy's name was, I can't remember off the top of my head, off his name, for swearing, cursing David out. And Solomon said, okay, I will treat you, this man, you must stay here in Jerusalem for the rest of your life. You leave the city, I'll kill you, because of how you treated my dad. And so Solomon, David assigned Solomon the avenger of the death of this, in this case, it was the cursing of David against this man, because what he cursed him with was a death penalty. So David said, make sure this man dies, Solomon. If something goes wrong, give the opportunity to kill him. So Solomon set him up as the recipient, and Solomon be the avenger of death. I think it was 3 years went by. The man then leaves the city to go after some slaves and escape from him. Comes back. Solomon hears about it and says, wait a minute. You left the city. You broke the rules. You're dead now. And so he killed him. Actually, I think he had, I forgot who he had killed him. Benai? I think it was his commander who actually did the physical killing, but Solomon ordered the execution. So you have an example of how an Avenger of Death would work. The Avenger is known by the assailants. They know who each other are. They are aware of the circumstance, and people else around are also aware of it. So it's a public, knowledgeable thing. Solomon's is written down. He wrote it down in the book of 2 Kings, 1 Kings, anyway, of how his worked out. So we have physical documentation. But either way, the Avenger knew who he was, and the assailants knew who he was. So they knew each other and knew to be aware of each other, and the assailant, the person who did the problem, chose to violate and run the risk of being killed. Make sense? Now, Jerusalem technically was not a city of refuge. It was just a city. Well, that's what it's doing. That's what they did. Solomon treated Jerusalem as if he was the city of refuge, and it really wasn't. But he gave, I believe it was Sheba, I could be wrong on his name. Do not curse the leaders of your country. That is in the Deuteronomy. I forgot which chapter it is. I can't think who it is. It is cited as an example of dishonoring your father and your mother, which in the Ten Commandments is a death penalty. So that is the example cited as the extrapolation. I'm not saying they're all justified. I'm just saying what actually the Torah, what the Bible says. So we can disagree with it, but that's what it says. That's what actually happened. So we can disagree. Imagine these are men who are living their lives. These are not necessarily all 100% godly human beings. These are men, they're human beings. So they're living their life. This is how they applied their understanding, and this is what they did with it. Right or wrong, that's what they did. Right, he may have said, he may or may not have said so. Solomon did not cite he was following the Torah. Right, supposed to follow the Torah, theoretically he would do it right. Today, you went David and Solomon, they did a lot of things. Yes, the other David.
So there's a lot of reading here, and there's a lot of story.
Ton.
And there's a lot going on. But the one thing I found quite interesting, and I may not fully understand it or even express it properly, but it seems to me that as they get to the Jordan River, they've conquered this land, and the two tribes are saying, hey, look at all this. We've got tons of cattle, and this is great grazing land, and we don't need to cross the river. Hence, Moses says, well, you know, as long as you help us destroy the Canaanites when we cross over, I'm sure we're good with that. However, God was like, no, that's not the plan that I have for you. This isn't the land I gave to you, and therefore the punishment and the dispersion for 40 years that they travel. Moses goes into great detail to list all these places that they traveled. And with a rough count, depending on where you start, where you stop, let's say there's pretty close to 40.
Yeah.
If you think about that, for 40 years, they traveled to 40 plus or minus a couple different places. So that's basically depending on how, I mean, just rough math, that's once a year, they're packing up and moving. So if you think about that, with the hundreds of thousands of cattle and sheep and animals and people and property, and I mean, this is a huge ordeal. Not only that, but as they move from one place to another, they finally get camped in, the animals are grazing, they've got the water, they've got the wood, they're set up, and God says, and the smoke moves, and they have to move again. As soon as they get comfortable.
They're tired of it, yeah.
Not only a really long punishment, and of course we understand why, because he says, those that sinned against me are not going to cross. And it took 40 years for those descendants to die off to where they could cross over. But it's just amazing when you look at that whole picture and you think about Moses leading this tribe of rebellious, ungrateful people. However, we know that it wasn't all of them, but quite a lot of, I mean, for him to just stay faithful and keep the faith is like Noah building the ark out in the middle of the desert where it hasn't rained for millennials, and and he's still keeping the faith 75 years later. He's still building an ark out in the desert. I mean, talk about two men with faith just amazes me.
They are impressive men. Honorable mention. There's as far as the camping sites, it's funny. There were roughly 42 sites, depending on your exact count. The first 14 or so of those cities, they moved that in the first year and a half. That's the first year and a half they were traveling around. And then the last 8 of them, they moved after Aaron died, or last year of Aaron's death. So they're just traveling there. So you got about 20 or so they lived in and moved for 38 years. So a year and a half goes by, they move again. Now, the Torah, when it explains when they're moving, it says they will stay there for a day, a week, a month, or years. They never know if the camp gets up and goes, and then it goes. Yeah, it would be very tiring of getting up and going and getting old pretty quick. But also keep in mind, if they stay in one spot for too long, what happens? You run out of food, you run out of place, you have human waste and everything else that's going to build up and muck on the ground. You got to get out and move anyway, because that's just the nature of sewage and human beings. What was that? Bedouins. Yeah, Bedouins moved more frequently, but yeah, so like a nomadic peoples. It is tiring. It is gets old. And I'm sure there's probably some legitimacy to that desire to stay. Yes, Jeff.
Well, you know, to what Dave was saying, it's like the Lord was saying, if you did not want to enter the land of my rest, thinking that you will not find shalom there, you will not have shalom for these next 40 years, and you will be moving right around, and you will not have rest.
Right. that's what it is. Yep. All right, let's see. Any other questions or comments? All right, let's see. Where were we at? We got a few things rattled off to you. Jump through some of this stuff. A lot of stuff we covered, as obviously last year, we covered the same topic. We'll do a few basic hits of the same subject matter. Let's see here. We already discussed about the details of oaths, so how oath can be overruled by either either the husband or father, as well as by Jewish extrapolation through a court or a tribal parent of the tribe or head of the tribe. So I won't go through all the details of that, other than the concept of, do we like that? Is it good to have your vows and your oaths overruled by somebody else? Give me an example. When you're young, know what you're doing. Note the example it cites was that the woman was in her, from her father's house, was young in her youth. So she has not been married. In her youth, they debate what this means. I disagree with the rabbinical definition of 13 years old. My definition, the Bible says, men are all accountable for everything you do at the age of 20 and up. My opinion, in her youth means she's under the age of 20, unmarried, still in her dad's house. That's my opinion, because it's consistent with the biblical definition. Judy's definition doesn't define that. She's only in her youth until the day she turns 13, then she's no longer her father's house. She's now, any vows she makes, any oath she makes, cannot be overruled by her dad. How many of you were teenagers once and made dumb vows, dumb oaths, dumb things? I said, I'll never do that again. I'll never do it at all. Oops. Do you want your dad to overrule it? Yes, you would. Do you want God to overrule your vows now when you screw up? Yes, you would. The symbolism's the same. Would you want Messiah, your husband, to overrule your vows when you make an incorrect or a bad vow? Yes, you would. Does it matter whether it comes from God or the Messiah? Not necessarily, because the instructions pretty much are the same. Your vows get overruled. The symbolism here, of course, when it comes to overruling vows, so always remember that though it says women, so I'll talk about women and how the vow is associated with the husband or the father, the symbolic version of women is you're the bride of Messiah, right? So every human being is part of that. So overruling is supposed to be symbolic of God or Messiah overruling your vows, your oaths. We already gave examples of oaths and vows earlier. I won't go through all the details now. And Judaism applied this overrule process, though it says specifically for women in their youth or wives or of those cases, they applied that overruling capability also to boys who don't have dads around to tell them otherwise. There are orphans, they exist, that happen sometimes, or young men are just plain know nothing and they say dumb things. Yeah, we all did that. So that they can get overruled anyway by either the parent or the patriarch of the clan grandparents, they can all be overruled, said, you're too dumb, shut up, go sit down, we'll discuss this later. We'll teach you more later as you grow up. Men do the same thing, makes no difference. So they applied it to men as well, though it does not specifically state that here, it was applied that way. When the boy turned the age of 20 years and up, it was no longer applied. He is expected to fulfill his vow. And they didn't apply it. Actually, I take it back. Sorry. Let's scratch that. Judaism applied it to 13 and up. When the boy reached 13, just a boy specifically, when the boy reached 13, Judaism said, if you make a vow or an oath, it is bound to you. Your dad can't overrule it. There is no options for you. You must carry it out for your whole life. And the whole point of them doing so, now granted, I argue it should have been 20. That's my biblical opinion based on what the Bible is consistent with. But the idea is, watch what you say. It means something. Your voice, your honor, your vows, they mean something. It's not arbitrary, flippant conversations. The whole point is for men to learn to be men. That what you say matters. What you vow, what you agree to do, matters. It's not an immaterial thing. It's this week, I'll change my opinion next week. It is a permanent thing. The idea was to teach them what this means. So they only applied it to young men in that instance. But women, they applied it a lot longer than that. But that's still how it was generally applied. Yes. Hold on a minute. His hand's over here. The other yes. Go ahead.
What you implied, I think, if I understood correctly, that these overrulings happened when there were vows of that were detrimental to you.
Overrulings would happen when they were detrimental for you. That was the intent.
What about, it seems to me like what the scripture said in that passage was any vow that a woman made could be overruled by her superior.
Right. When they're referring to the overrule process which Judaism applied, they took the father and husband, that is one category. They broke out and cut out a new category of overruling. So in the case of the Torah's definition of husband, well, they overrule two different things. They overrule two different kinds of things.
Yeah.
So a husband and father can overrule any vow, good or bad, makes a difference.
Daughter.
For a daughter.
Not for a son.
Not for a son. Any vow, good or bad.
This is a big problem we have in our society with the Torah, if that is in fact the case. Because our society doesn't agree with that.
Our society?
Yeah, I know it doesn't matter to us, but it does matter. It matters to those that we're trying to talk to about the Torah.
Explain.
A woman should have the same rights as a man if she is an adult. If she makes a vow, that should stand.
Right, and it does if she's an adult.
No, you just said it doesn't.
Wait. It says a youth in her father's house or a husband. So if she's divorced,
okay.
A widow, or she's no longer in her father's house but not married, this doesn't apply.
Okay. So it's just a little different. An adult male in his father's house can make a vow and it stands. An adult female in her mother's house can make a vow, and it doesn't necessarily stand.
Right, doesn't necessarily stand. Right.
So we look at it as, the way we look at it is, yes, this is a metaphor for the way we should be with Yahweh, and we accept that.
Right.
But our society doesn't.
Right. Society does not accept it. Western society, Western culture does not run this way. Many cultures still do. Yeah, many cultures still do run this way. Western cultures don't. Middle Eastern cultures still run similarly, not the same, but similar, and actually some, but not all, of Eastern cultures run similarly. They still obey this process. A husband or father can overrule his wife or daughters, if they're young, their agreement, saying, no, you can't do that. You're not going to because of whatever reason, this, that, or the other thing. Right, because I don't like it, it's sufficient enough. Whatever his reason is, he gives a reason. So they still run that way. Our Western culture throws it all out. We won't do that. Not acceptable, intolerable events, or double standard system. That's how we look at it. That's not how God looks at it. It's how humans look at it. And humans are humans. We do things a little screwy in our own heads anyway. We look at a lot of things a little off from what God had intended. Now, some things God said that we would find abhorrent. The Levirate marriage, the whole when a woman marries a man, and he dies with no sons, that his brother comes in to have a child, so that his older brother or other brother will continue on the family line, then this guy goes back into his own life. That's abhorrent to our way of thinking in our Western culture. It would never be done. You would never do such a thing. Well, God doesn't work it that way. And look at it this way. When we examine our culture, what do we do when a husband dies? Well, our heart says, well, did he have life insurance? Hopefully. How's Social Security paying? And I say, okay, good job, honey. Good luck. Have fun. Catch you later. That's how our culture does it. Our culture says, okay, if a husband dies, instead of saying, okay, we need to figure out a way of taking care of her and making her live through the family and stay part of the family and continue on survival, all this good stuff, we say, go away, tough luck, you know, pat you on the back, here's the $255 check from the government, whatever it may be, to bury the poor guy, and go live. Go do your thing, whatever it may be. Well, in God's way, he may look at us and say, that doesn't make sense. We may say, well, it makes perfect sense. Well, he says, well, I disagree with you. So we have a disagreement on how our culture does something versus how God does something. His intent, God says, make sure she and her family stay inside the husband's family. They are cared for and taken care of their entire lives. To do that, make sure the inheritance stays, so she has a territory that's her own house, her own property, everything that stays with her and her children. For generations to come, she's always settled and taken care of. And the family always takes care of her. That was his intent, to build her and keep her stuck inside, as opposed to, sorry, you died. Go marry somebody else. That's different. We have a different way of doing things in our culture. Not saying our culture is right or wrong. We just do it very differently than what God intended it. But our culture is probably not the best, but it's still. To understand it. Yes. Understand God first. It is not easy to explain without knowing and understanding what God's looking at. Yes. Daniel.
This is a painful subject.
Painful subject. Come on.
Only because my only experience, personal experience with vows, is witnessing a congregation more or less being manipulated into making vows in the church. And it's usually around supporting missionaries or a building fund or, you know, but asking people to make a vow before God, you know, to pledge $100 a month for something. It just left a bad taste in my mouth. But again, that's my only experience with vows. I knew nothing about vows other than those times I witnessed that.
Yeah, personally, I have not witnessed such things, although I have heard of them, of vows being that way. But me, vows are very I self-inspired things. I want to go do X, Y, Z, whatever it may be. But in the case of manipulation or use, anyone can manipulate you. we're all subject to that. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, and actually that was the one thing that the sages took up in like the tractate Nazir, in between all the crazy discussions of how you can go into a Nazirite vow or this or that. One of the things they specifically said, you cannot be coerced into it.
Right, it's a
no
big
one
deal.
Can say, hey, you should be a Nazir for 90 days.
Right.
Right? 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 And then you get a whole group of people and say, yeah, right?
Right?
No. Because if you're coerced into it, it can be basically annulled.
Yeah. They wipe it out. If you were not, because they say that you were not fully informed, it is you've made it an error. You have to fully understand within your being what this is and what it means to you and how it's going to affect everything, and you have to be self-inspired to go do it. Not a kick in the butt, hey, go do this, come on, everybody else did it. It would be wiped out. So that's an illegal vow. It's not legitimate. Yes, David.
So as they're preparing to cross over the Jordan, crossing over, become Hebrew in the land, and God is telling them how they are to be living and set apart and his people and how they're going to act. And these people live by honor and shame. And that is who they are and what they stand for. So when you're talking about vows and oaths that our children are making or immature-minded folk that could possibly bring shame, dishonor to their families, why you could see perfectly well why these could be overruled, mm-hmm. because you could bring shame to your family by yep. certain oaths and vows that you that one may take.
Yep.
And so to restore honor to the family, the father, the head of the house, would override a certain vow if that was something that wasn't right or that the family value stood for.
Yep, yep. And your vows can cause harm and you not be aware of it. And breaking them is also a big deal. We cite, for example, Achan, the guy who stole from Jericho's when they took Jericho, he took a piece of gold or fabric, whatever it was, And he hid it in his tent. His whole family knew about it, but he hid it in his tent. When they went to the next town, and a whole bunch of Israelite soldiers die. They're killed.
Yeah.
Anyway, what happened? What went wrong? Well, his breaking the agreement he made with God, all made the same agreement, he broke the agreement, he broke his vow, he broke his agreement. Not that picking something up is illegal, picking up a fabric piece item, nothing's wrong with that, nothing wrong, it's perfectly fine. But it was an impermissible item. It was vowed away for you. It was not permitted to you. He did it and he broke that. There's a lot of deaths. So when you make a
ban, everything was supposed to be destroyed.
Right, right.
And he stole from
what
was under the
exactly.
ban.
Exactly. So all those, it was an agreement that was made. Everything gets, nothing's touched. Just leave it alone. And he broke it. Well, that breaking cost a lot of other lives later on. It was short while later, a few days later, a lot of men died. And what happened? What went wrong? And they figured it all out with their drawing of straws or however they, I'm not sure how they did it. They narrowed it down to Achan and his family. So not only he died, his wife died, his children died. They were all killed. So, but how can that be? Now look how many men already died whose husbands won't be coming back, the families whose husbands are gone, whose fathers are gone, all the orphans that now exist. What happened? Well, because of his thieving, the breaking of his vow, the agreement he made, all of them made, it affected so many other people and destroyed the reputation of all of Israel, because now the people of Canaan said, you can be defeated. At this point, no one could defeat them. Who goes to battle and doesn't lose anybody? In the Midianites, no one dies, but you wipe out the entire tribe. Take Jericho and it falls down and everybody dies. That would put terror in everyone's eyes. They're undefeatable. Well, then now this event happens. Now we can defeat them. You encourage your enemies. So it destroyed the entire people's reputation by Achan's action. Vows are a big deal. It is a big deal in their society, and it affects many, many people. Yes.
Yeah, you think about here in this country back in the late 2000s, you had a lot of people who made vows to buy houses they knew darn well they couldn't afford.
Right.
And when stuff happened and they obviously could no longer afford it and they bailed out on those loans, the whole economy of this country went for a long time. And we still really haven't fully recovered from that because a bunch of people made vows, quote, unquote, to pay mortgages on homes they knew they couldn't afford.
Agreements are agreements. That's what intent is.
And actually, to her point, it's amazing that people might take issue with this and annulling of vows, but they sure didn't take issue with the government annulling all the vows of those mortgages that people did pretty irresponsibly.
Yeah. They like that part because it saves them money. yes, Gary.
Well, I guess a couple of things. On the vow thing and having somebody that can revoke your vow, I definitely agree there's a perspective on honor versus shame. But for me personally, it's more positive to look at the freedom aspect. You know, you've got a person, a human, who may or may not have been tricked into something, you know, or maybe just didn't have as much information as they should have, whatever. But they've basically found themselves in bondage, or maybe they didn't even see the bondage that they were in because of the vow. Maybe, you know, their husband and father, when they saw it, they recognized something. So what they were doing is not necessarily bringing honor back to the family, even if it was a bad decision. What they're doing is they're freeing this member of their family from a bondage that maybe that person doesn't even see.
Yes.
So for me, it's more about freedom. And then the other thing with Achan, you know, and that, you know, I've always kind of looked at that and, you know, especially when I was young, like, why did he kill the entire family? Like, seriously, he's the one that did it, not everybody else. But looking at it right now, it's like, well, you know what? You think about it. And if God only took Achan's life, but the rest of his kids and his wife, you know, they live, then all of their neighbors would have hated them the rest of the time they lived there, because all of their neighbors lost family members. And plus, it put the entire nation in trepidation for future battles and things. So realistically, you know, God can resurrect somebody whenever he wants to, and he can, you know, give them information and they can be judged righteously in his time. But he actually kind of saved that family by taking them early from a lifetime of misery. And he removed a stumbling block from the nation, because the rest of the people in the nation would have this bitterness in their heart, possibly, until that family was gone. So it really brought freedom in a lot of ways, more than just, okay, wiping out this family.
That's true. The wiping out of families is a big deal, obviously, to Dathan and Abiram and Korah's family, as far as not their whole family, but just their immediate, you know, wife, children. They had a few of them were right there. Did it a few times along the way. It is a form of rebellion when the person chooses to do those things. Whatever form you can argue, it's a form of rebellion. Right? Not against necessarily just people, but against God himself. And we've already read through Numbers and Exodus. He doesn't like rebels. Because rebels is not his thing. It's like, yay, rebels. No, it's against the rebel. He wants them to follow the instructions. There's lots of leeway within the instructions, but follow the instructions. It means something, because it affects not just you, but everybody, and how God is looked upon by other cultures. They look at you and say, okay, who do you follow? What kind of life do you live? That determines what kind of God you're following. If you're living a garbage life, why would I care about the God you follow? You're worthless to me, and so is this God of yours, which is silliness. Well, you don't want that. He doesn't want that. It destroys his name. So all these actions of rebellion and things we go against will always affect how humans and others see God too. He doesn't like that. You're right. He can bring anybody back he wants. That's a quick, easy fix for him. Death is a temporary status, not a permanent one, like we look at it. And also, when you make a mistake, it is better to pay for it in this life than it is the next one. We learned that from David and Joab, his nephew, who murdered Abner, I think it was. He murdered Abner, and the instruction was, David told his son, make sure Joab dies for this. He murdered someone. And I didn't order their murder, he did it all on his own. Well, David starts with, make sure his hairs don't go gray. Don't let him die of old age. But why would it matter? The guy dies, he dies. Who cares, right? Because Joab, even though he was David's nephew, had to learn that, hey, murder is still murder. Pay for it now while you're still alive. Then pay for it after you're brought back. And God says, now it's time to pay for your murder. The one you didn't get paid for, the one you got away with. Well, when you're a spirit, how do you pay for a murder? You don't. There's no blood to spill. It's just you. You don't go into heaven. We can't take it with us, right? You can't take the payment method with you. You can't take your blood with you. The only payment left is one, and it's you. You don't want to pay for murder at that time. Pay for murder while you still can. That's a big deal. So David gave Joab a way out, a way of everlasting life, by having Solomon executed for the murder. Which is like, well, it's strange, but reality is that's what happens in we do the spiritual versus physical things. We want murderers to pay now versus pay later. There isn't an option later. Okay, let's continue on. Let's see here. I'm not going to go through all this detail. There's a few things I want to rattle off to you. Numbers 31, when it goes to battle against Midian. I respect Moses' decision to go this quickly. He didn't dilly-dally, even though he knew at the end of it he'd be dead. Chapter 31 of Numbers. Numbers 31. Let me erase some of this stuff. So God's instruction to Moses was that you go avenge them against the Midianites, and after this you'll be gathered to people, which means after you finish this job, Moses, you're going to die. And Moses, an old man, honorably said, let's go do it. Then say, well, I'll get to next month. Let me drag this out a little longer, like some of us would like to do. He goes right to it. I respect that. He's an old man, he lived a long life, but I respect his honor. Say, hey, get the job done and get it done quickly while I'm still alive. So he did it. Give him credit for that one. So, of course, they all go. The 12,000 from all the tribes go. I disagree with Rashi. Levi was not among them. 12,000 tribes, you have one for each tribe, not Levi. Rashi believes Levi was included. I disagree for obvious reasons, because it states when they divvy up the bounty of who gets what, Levi's portion is then treated as if it's part of the children of Israel who didn't go, as opposed to the people who did go. So Levi clearly was amongst those who didn't go. So now Levi, 12,000 all go. Not a single man dies as far as they go against the Midianites. They capture all the various women and young children, the flocks and such. And what's Moses mad about? Yeah, what does it matter? No. 12,000 from each. No, sorry. 12,000 total. It was 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 men. So this is not 12,000 from each tribe. It's 12,000 of the tribe. So it's not 12,000 from each tribe. It's 1,000 from each tribe. 12 tribes, 12,000 people. Sorry. I may have misspoke that earlier. So women were alive, so were all the children. Yeah. So what's the big deal about women? They can't be kept alive. Why? Yeah. In the culture of this time, it's a big deal to understand this. Women are not property, but they're really close to it. Okay? It's not that a husband could buy or sell his wife, but a father can assign or sell his daughter as a wife to somebody, whoever he sees is most economically beneficial to him. So that is, women are a type of property in that respect only. But that's a big deal. It means something. It's on purpose that way. It's not by male chauvinism. It actually means something. The idea of the women being treated that way is that any children they have will not belong to their dad or their mom, but rather will help the husband's family grow. The idea behind having women, having children, is to have you, the husband's line, to expand so that your property, your lifestyle, your benefits will all increase. If they didn't treat women in this fashion, women would still be considered part of their parents' household. So they have kids, well, yeah, but it's grandkids to her mom and dad too. Well, let's split the time, let's train them. Mom and dad, her parents disagree with how they're being raised, and like the grandparents bickering, let's visit holidays at my house, not their house. Also goes back and forth when it comes to parents. Women weren't allowed to permit it to do such things. The idea was that give the women, their job is to promote that tribe or that household growth and prosperity and success. They were all treated that way. As a result, where are her loyalties? To her husband, not to her parents. Her parents may have raised her differently. To believe in a different God, to worship it this way, to do that, makes no difference. Her loyalties must be to the household she marries into. Hence, we get the idea of Ruth and what happens with Boaz and how she attached herself. The idea is that the loyalty applies to whom you are married to, not to who you are born from. The husband, a male's job, is your loyalties are where you came from. Your family line, your father, your grandfather, that family line. The husband's loyalties are fixed in one way, women's loyalties are fixed in a different way, and hers are designed to shift or move and apply to her husband. So, when the women have children, they have sons or daughters, makes a difference. Their job is to raise their children according to how their husband wanted them raised, in that fashion, that religious, that belief system. So when you have a bunch of women coming off from Midian, how were their husbands wanting them to raise their kids? Idolatry. Look at how the women were used with Balaam and the descendant of Peor. They were used as sexual property to be bought or sold without money to be used as a way to corrupt a bunch of people. Is that honorable? No. What's the objective? To get all these people to worship a different god, to drag them off a different way. To drive them to be like the Midianites, to bring them back to where the parents want them to be, which obviously doesn't apply, should not have applied. So the idea of Moses comes along, you can't let the women live, empty those who have had husbands, who have been married, because their loyalties are now fixed to that husband. Either the husband's dead, the lords are still fixed, and their children are supposed to be raised according to the husband's instructions. So, get rid of them, and now we're going to children. You have males, you have females. What does it matter if the little baby boys live?
They'll throw up to your
enemy. Why? What does it matter?
They're committed to their father and their mother.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, what's a son's job? Son's loyalty is to his father's line. His father's family line. That's how his loyalty works. What's a daughter's job? Whatever husband she's attached to, that's her loyalty. It moves or shifts. So Moses points out, you have to kill the women who are mothers. They don't teach your children accordingly. And the sons have to be wiped out too. Oh, well, it's really hard as a soldier to come along and kill little baby boys. That's not an easy thing to do. That'd be hard for most men. I think just about anybody would have a hard time with that. But that's the instruction. The idea of the daughters who had not known a man, they were too young, or whatever, mostly, like the old case, they're just too young. What did they do with them?
They keep them.
To do what?
To go along with the
family. Yeah. What would you do with a bunch of daughters? Yeah, you use them as wives to your sons and to your grandsons and whatever, or slaves, whatever happens to be needed. The daughters were then, when they complete that, now we point out that in Torah it instructs when this happens, you have to give the daughter 30 days to mourn the loss of her parents and all this stuff as far as a cycle before she's permitted to be given to your sons. The little daughters, that they can be married to the Israelite sons. And then their loyalty will then attach to Israel, as is their training. This isn't a foreign concept to them. They're trained from children. When you're married, your loyalty belongs to your husband. Every day, every life. You're married, loyalty belongs to your husband. That's how it works. They know this is the normal procedure. So this is nothing new or strange or bizarre for them. This is normal how it works. This is a common event. So this whole process that we look at it as abhorrently, ooh, yuck, they killed a bunch of babies. God doesn't necessarily look at it that way. And in particular, Moses did not see it that way. Now, mind you, is death permanent? No. Yeah, because God is the one who's pointing out and doing this. Do men get to go along and says, you know what, I don't like that country, let's kill everybody? No, we don't get to do that. When God instructs to go do something, that's one detail. When men instruct, doesn't work that way. Because men are arbitrary, we are mind changers, we're flippant, we decide to change things all the time. We make dumb vows, we have to undo them. So those are men, yeah, fickle. God isn't. And God can undo anything he chooses whenever he's ready or whenever he wants to. All these children, he can say, okay, now the time's, come back, we have something to talk about and teach you. This is always open to him, it's not open to any of us to make these decisions. Yes.
But God does make, sometimes they do have to kill everybody.
Yes, he makes instructions a number of times.
If he puts them under the ban, everything dies, including the animals. Everything.
Yep. I think because Amalek was that way. Jericho was that way. I don't remember all of them. There's a few of them that are that way. He's like, don't take anything. They're all corrupt to all evil. And a lot of that, we look back to, well, what does it matter whether the horse dies or the cow dies? Why can't you take that? It doesn't have a loyalty. Because you as a person will know where you got it from. It never leaves. Yeah, you have to kill the animals too, because you know, I get these you know, flock of sheep. Well, it's because we killed so-and-so over there and we took all the stuff. You now have a benefit from that man's death. You now have a sense of, well, thank you.
You're richer
from it. You profit from it. Abraham pointed that out when he dealt with Sodom and Gomorrah. He said, I don't want anybody to think that I made a dime off of you. So keep everything. I don't want to touch it. Yes.
I'm thinking if you were saying something about the not Levi, but if it's not Levi included in the army, that means because their job is not to fight these battles on earth, which is the same thing that Jesus said, that Christ, the Messiah said in front of Pilate when he said, where are your followers? He said, well, if my followers were of this world, they would fight, but they are not of this world. They do not fight.
Right. Which is consistent.
Us off of the hook here.
We're not murderers. We don't kill people. The gods of Egypt you punished.
So they are gods.
So it makes sense as far as why Moses would have done this. It's crazy to us. It's not something crazy in biblical perspective or necessarily God's, because again, he's the one who brings it back like that if he chooses to. Not that he has, but he can.
This world is different from God's. God owns everything.
Right.
This world belongs to whom?
That's what Jesus taught. Let's continue on here. I won't go through all the different chapters of all the inheritance, but I want to bring a few details up to you regarding who inherits what and some details as to why. Well, because this side was already marked. I shouldn't have erased it.
I like that. Wait, but the other one, huh? The old one.
I should clean it better. I should clean it last week, and I just didn't get to it. Too busy, too whatever. Inheritance. What's your inheritance?
Kingdom.
What else? What was that? The land?
The people, the land, and the end.
As a believer.
We have power.
What is your inheritance?
Everything that God has.
Kingdom, right?
Kingdom.
What is the kingdom? What does that mean? Can flesh and blood inherit it?
No.
It's a city. It's all God's. It's inclusive of the city, and everything comes out of it. It's a whole old Jerusalem. So kingdom. Yeah, it can't be inherited by flesh. Now, mind you, in chapter 32, is it flesh inheriting the land? Yes, they're all tribes. They're inheriting to have physical property. So in your case, do you inherit that land? Not that land. What do you inherit? Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. So what doesn't? A new Jerusalem, you get life, but it's a permanent life. The kingdom requires a permanent life, because obviously flesh and blood doesn't get to go in. Well, not go in, it doesn't get to inherit it. So kingdom is a type of life that you get. Just like they get. They get a life in their land they get to live in, right? No difference. So this is a believer's job. Are you still a believer? This will aid it. Thank you. Looks strange, okay. Thank you. Believers, and believer in Messiah, your inheritance is the kingdom or life. Is it the same? Yeah, by adoption in particular. Is it the same inheritance as Joe Schmuley number one versus Joe Schmuley number two? They both get the same inheritance? Is there a difference? Anybody? Anybody here, on this hand, let's pretend this person is a believer in God. Pretend there's a person here I'm pointing out to. He believes in God, he gets the inheritance kingdom and everlasting life. The verse over here also is a God, inheritance kingdom and everlasting life. What's the difference?
Well, it depends on what you're believing in.
Oh, what are you doing? There's details. There's details beyond part of this inheritance. There's different types of obedience that are implied here.
They'll be different.
They inherit this, but it's not everybody gets the exact same thing. We get differences. And how do we know that's true? Well, look at chapter 32 in Numbers. What do they all get? Different sections of the land. Do all of them intermingle and interact and live in their own, inherit their own properties and go back and forth? He specifically stated at the end of 36, no, don't do that. When you inherit the kingdom of life, the kingdom of God, there are certain things you get to inherit, and certain tasks or certain responsibilities, certain property that belongs to you. Well, it's different from person to person, from tribe to tribe. So in God's instructions for Numbers, M-U-N. And it's in the 32 as well as 36. Is that when it comes to inheritance transferring from one person to the next, no, don't do that. You can't have inheritance traveling from tribe to tribe.
Right.
It can't travel. So if somebody gets a particular kingdom, flavor, life, whatever it may be, I'm not going to argue what it is, who cares. You can't transfer that to somebody else. Somebody else is not going to inherit the same thing as you. They can inherit something similar, but it's not the same. Well, what does it matter? What is it? Who do we care if it's the same or if it's similar? Look at the tribes. The tribes all have different tasks assigned to them, different ways of living, different traditions. They're all part of the same people, the same overall tribe of Israel, but they all have their own niches, their own little sections, their own responsibilities. I believe it's Apostle Paul, who said, we're all the same body, but the same parts. You all belong to the same thing, but some of you do this and some of you do that. You have different assigned tasks, all through the adoption through into Messiah. This is how it's done. It doesn't make you less, it makes you different. Right, you're just part of it. If I'm missing my hand, I'm missing a big part of me. Well, I would need that part too. It's no less important than the other hand or the other knee. I need them all. I use them all. So each part has its function. Each part has distinct differences because your relationship with God is different than my relationship with God, isn't it? We're different. We're distinctly different. Carrie.
I was just thinking a good micro view of this is, a couple weeks ago, where he lined out which families of the priests and Levites dealt with which articles in the temple and who carried what and who wrapped what and this and that.
Exactly.
They all worked in the temple, but they each had their own individual jobs, their own responsibilities.
Exactly. So as we learn as believers, we know our inheritance may be this, but our inheritance is not restricted to just this generic form. It has specific details that we are not aware of necessarily, but they'll be part of it. It has to do with how our relationship with God works and how He is dealing with our specific inheritance and abilities and tasks to do. So each tribe has its function, and it stays within that tribe, which once you have your inheritance, it stays with you. Don't get there and give it away or share with other people and say, here, you have it, I don't want it anymore. It stays within that function, within that task, within that responsibility, within that family. So all this stuff stays. It doesn't get to travel around and migrate around from place to place. Not all of our inheritance are equal. They're equal in the respect that they are alive in the kingdom of God, but they aren't necessarily the same task. They don't say look the same. They look similar, but not say the same. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say the perfect example is in the Bible with the women that they say, okay, well, the women can have the inheritance of land because they have no husbands or fathers.
Right.
But if they marry another into another tribe that already has land, you don't combine those lands.
Right.
She leaves that behind to those people of that family.
Exactly.
So it doesn't transfer.
It's a big deal. So inheritance, my relationship is different than my wife's relationship to God. Whatever my inheritance is, whatever her inheritance is, will not be the same. They may be similar, but they're not going to be the same. Just like two of you or any of you. If you have our spouses or our children, the inheritance is distinctly different. How many of us grow up and have our children grow up and they raise up, realize they make decisions that we would never have made. They make choices we never would have done. I never would do that. I wouldn't do that. And yet, that's their part of their relationship with God. They've got to work through what they are, and they'll build their own inheritance relationship with Him, whatever it may be. God willing, it's a good one. But and it's all different. And one of us has a different inheritance. We have the same overall inheritance, but it's different in its subtleties. It doesn't transfer. It doesn't just because you move on from one region to the region doesn't mean your inheritance changes. It's always the same in your relationship with God. So it's important for us as people to understand this means something to us. We're not just reading out of arbitrary so-and-so got such and such land. It's relationship to us as well. Yes.
Also, it said that the Bible said Jesus said that in the end, he said that those who teach not according to the commandments will be the least in the kingdom.
Right. It doesn't say they won't be there. Just
they'll
be the least.
But they're the least, so maybe the least land that might produce some prunes compared to some apples. Right.
Who knows?
Could be oil underground.
Who knows? It doesn't say they won't be there. Just maybe they'll maybe be least.
There,
yeah, not necessarily.
Not sure
yeah, I don't know. It could be at least in quantity. Who knows? Let's move on. There's one more thing I want to rattle off to you. In the division up of the land, the inheritance side and who gets what, all kind of stuff, the basic map... Get out of the wind here. The inheritance as far as the borders will all rattle off essentially along these lines that God specked out. Here's your northern border, your southern border, your eastern border, your western border. Rattle them all off where they all go. Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh, where are they?
They're on the outside.
Outside. That is not considered part of the land of Canaan. As a result, it is not divvied up in the inheritance list here. What does that mean? While these inheritance were broken up into sections, Ephraim's had a funky little funny shape. Ephraim's looked like a little bow tie. You had Ephraim here, you had Judah was down here, Simeon. There's Issachar and Zebulun, and Dan was split between a spot here and a spot up here. Lots of his spots. It's the fan blowing against the speaker on my lapel, the lapel mic. Sorry, I should get out of the way. Yes, it's great. This is divvied up with lots. What about this side? Was that divvied up with lots? No, it was not. Now, the tribes conquered certain territories. Half of Manasseh had to fight for his land up here. He fought it. He got it. It's his. Well, Gad and Reuben, they divided this section up here, which is Og and Bashan. Or not Bashan. Og and Sihon. They broke up. They fought it. They inherited. They owned it. But it was not given by lot. They requested. They got it. So it was theirs. But half Manasseh, it wasn't given to them. They had to fight for it to earn it. So it's a distinctly different. This over here was divided by lots. This over here was not. Why does it matter? It wasn't originally part of it. Is anything wrong with it? No, it wasn't originally part of it. There were three cities of refuge, what they put here. What does that tell us? If it's not part of God's plan, that's a big deal. What does it tell us if it's not part of God's plan? God's divvying up was on this side, but not that side. What it tells us is, how did these tribes get this side? By conquering. By taking and conquering, right? That they, by war, by acquiring through battle. That tells us that if, let's pretend for a moment, this tribe decides, I want more land. And they expand. They'll take out this section over here. They have to divvy that up in lots. No. They conquered this in battle. You could expand your territory with conquering battle. It means whoever conquers it, it is yours. As opposed to the lot divvied up inheritance. So Lot's side with this, the lot process was done on this side, not on that side. This side was expanded through conquest, through taking over. They might take something. Exactly, that could happen. Yes.
Yeah, but that's a two-edged sword. You could lose it. Because if they lose the land by conquest, mm-hmm. then that's it.
Right, because it has both ways. So you can expand that way, but you can lose it that way too, which it did get conquested many, many times throughout the years. So the land was taken and gone back and forth a few different, I forgot how many, a whole bunch, as far as who took what. In this section, the point is we understand that as we expand, or as God expands his kingdom to incorporate more areas, that expansion isn't by a lot system, it's by a conquest or taking of the territory. And whoever does the job of taking it, that is now your new responsibility to take care and do that task or that job or that region, whatever it may be. So we can imagine if this is what God did here at this time, then when he comes to take over the world and have his new Jerusalem, now he has to sit there and acquire it. That's probably done similarly. And that as you go outside the city and start taking over lands and conquering for God's name, whoever does the conquering, what's your job now? Maintain it. That's yours. It's your inheritance. Maintain and work. This is your job to work. And this is the area you work and process and take care of. Because that's how God dealt with the men, the human beings, as they expanded. It's now your responsibility to take care for it, because you expanded it. If you lose it, you lose it. But it's yours to lose, yours to expand. Yes, Dan?
Is that why God said you can't own property that has walls around it?
I'm going to discuss the property of walls, because that's with cities and boundaries, which actually it is part of this section a little bit. But he did divvy up between unwalled cities versus walled cities, and how he broke them apart. And that in, when some it was inheritance, unwalled city was like a farm, or should be like farms. And so after, I think it's a 50-year cycle, they go back to the original owner. But walled cities inside the city itself, the houses would not go back. And they were done differently how they operated. They were, whoever bought them was permanently there. We'll discuss that when we get back to that section. Any questions so far? I'm going to close this up real quick. I have one more thing to rattle off to you, and I'm going to be done. We all have our pluses and minuses. We already discussed the various cities of refuge and such. I won't discuss all the inheritance of Levites. to the full extent as it did last time, but we'll just cover a little bit. The 42, 48 total for each great city, so because they got these six as well. They do, but I don't have time to go through all of them. I'm sorry. Oops. The basic territory. Have any of you ever heard the term a Sabbath day's journey?
Yes.
Yeah. Where'd you hear that from? Yeah, Christians. Well, yeah, it's in the Torah. It's in the New Testament. It talks about it. Where'd that come from? Yeah, the King James wrote the Sabbath day journey. They didn't invent it. It was written by many, many years earlier. The rabbis discussed this prior to Messiah's birth. The tradition of men. That's not the tradition of men that the Messiah observed. He observed the tradition of men. It wasn't anything wrong with it. So, Sabbath day journey was defined, if I recall correctly, to get this right, it was 8,000 cubits of travel. Yeah, it's about a couple miles. Yeah, a cubit is a foot and a half. Foot and a half. Cubits, foot and a half. So 8,000, anyway, the point is what they did, they said, okay, I have a given city. We'll call it city of size one. Whatever, how big it is, who cares? You can travel 8,000 cubits because you're allowed the 1,000 here outside the city to travel. That's all part of the city's territory of the undeveloped area. This is where the city trash dump is located, the ash heap, the garbage, the human waste. It's all dumped there. You don't want to hang out there. It's kind of gross. Then there's a crop section, which is out here, which is debatable. It's one or two. They debate whether it's 1,000 or 2,000. Nobody knows. But most argue it's 2,000. Rashi says it's one. Brian Bantz says it's two. There's an opinion. So they say, okay, you are allowed to travel in a given city on a Shabbat from this point to this point. Don't leave the city. That's the Sabbath day journey. That's where it comes from. So the idea, how far is that? Well, you got 6,000 here and 6,000... Sorry, 3,000 here, 3,000 there. So that's 6,000 cubits. The average size city of his day was 2,000 cubits across. So they said a Sabbath day journey is 8,000 cubits. So you could travel across the town that you live in on a Shabbat. You can travel from one in the town all the way to the other town without breaking the Shabbat. The idea is on Shabbats, don't travel from city to city. Don't travel from country to country. This is within inside your town. You can hang out. So we can't go anymore, right? This is a Sabbath day journey. So, and that's how it was determined. So anytime a Sabbath day journey is brought up in your Bible, which is in the New Testament a few times, not many, but a few times, that's what it's referring to. Roughly 8,000 cubits. It can vary some because the inner cities themselves may vary in size. You might have a 3,000 cubit city, you might have a 1,000 cubit city. Whatever that is, they would consider that a given. And the balance outside is where you were allowed to travel. So they came with the average of 8,000 cubits was considered a Sabbath day journey. It's about 2 miles, roughly. About 2 miles. Yeah. About 2 miles, roughly. It is not in the Torah, it's derived from the Torah. The Gemara. What they did, they said, all right, God said when he was giving the manna out, everybody stay in your tents. Well, does that mean I can't go to my neighbor's tent? Because they're right next to me? I can't chit-chat and talk with them during Shabbat?
No.
They
stay
in places. So this is how they determine, what is a place? What's a place? And what God said was giving manna out during the Exodus, it's okay, on Shabbat, stay where you belong, your places. Well, what is a place? What does that mean? What zone is that included? What does it mean? No one knows. It's okay, let's determine a place must be the place you're living. But what if I have a cow I have to milk? Because who cares? Cows don't care if it's Saturday or not. They get milked anyway. And he's out over here in the agricultural section of the city or the place I'm living. Can I go milk the cow or do I let it get mastitis and die? It's a Shabbat. I should go milk the cow. That's what they determine. So you have to be able to travel from your place to go take care of your immediate animals because they will suffer otherwise, and then return again. So they determine, okay, what is a place? What does God say a place is? He doesn't. Then say what a place is. This is what your place is. He just says your place. He allows, as you notice the Bible a lot, interpretation, allowing people to decide what does that mean. So the rabbis came up with the idea of 8,000 cubit average is about right, because most cities of their day with this size, they did not have cities the size of Santa Rosa. They didn't have cities the size of New York or Los Angeles. That didn't exist. These were small villages, small areas, not massive metropolis, you know, areas. So this is what they came up with. So when you have the Seventh-day Adventists showing up in the New Testament, that's what it's talking about. It's roughly 8,000 cubits is the travel which they were permitted to travel across a town or across a city. It seems innocuous and unimportant, but actually is very important, in that it identifies certain nuances in the New Testament that answer questions people have. For example, the road to Emmaus. Everybody heard the road to Emmaus?
Emmaus.
Emmaus, you pronounce it. How long is that?
I have no idea. 8,000 cubits.
Well, let's look at it. It's in Luke 24. 7 miles. So Emmaus is 7 miles from Jerusalem. Is that a Sabbath day journey? No, it is not. Because this is roughly 2,000 miles. Oh, sorry, 2,000. That is 7 miles. 8,000 feet is 2 miles. 8,000 cubits is 2 miles.
4 miles over the five.
2 miles. So that trip there is 7 miles. He wouldn't have done it. So it couldn't have been on Sabbath.
So he was, oh, okay.
Subtle details, you know, is what explains things. Now, Messiah was meticulous about not breaking any of the man-made or God-made Torah instructions. Very meticulous about that. Why would he do that? Wasn't he against man-made traditions? Ah, be careful what he's... Right. Only violated the Torah. He was against them. If they didn't violate the Torah, he didn't have any issue with it. So he wasn't trying to teach them that the man-made traditions were all evil. They weren't. The point is, when they violated God's instructions, trash them. If they didn't, nothing wrong with them. And that was a big deal, because Messiah... The Pharisees were trying their best to find something against him. Anything to find. A little tiny, minuscule thing to punish him. They couldn't. Now, if he was breaking all the man-made traditions, every one of them, they'd find a whole bunch against him. It'd be easy. He'd be in prison or executed really early on. That wouldn't have been a hard time. But it was hard for them to do. They spent a long time trying to find little tiny things. And so would he have violated that instruction? No, because they already knew. The Pharisees said, you go beyond a Sabbath-day journey, you've now broken the Sabbath. You've broken the fourth commandment. Oops. Is that a punishment by death? Yes, it is. For a Jew to break the fourth commandment, it is a punishment by death. So you don't do that. So they were looking for things to get to him. So these subtle details add up and mean things later on in the Torah. This is in the Bible. This is not a little window of one little thing in one spot. It has ramifications across the entire book as far as how things are settled up and pulled up. Yeah, so do I. I got to travel with mine.
Well, that helps us to understand that.
Almost 20 miles?
Isn't that
a how is it? 26. Oh, yours is 20. Yours is longer, huh? You're further out. Oh, really? Oh, it's another.
Walking,
yeah, which is just as bad, right? it does. I'm not telling us, you, me, that we're all, you know, violating the Sabbath day journey. That's not my business. The point is to tell you where it came from, what it meant, and how it was used. Between you and God, to you and God, me and God. I can't fix that. That's how life is. Ideally, there is a synagogue or a place of worship in every single town and village. That's what you'd want, right? What did the Pharisees do? They built a synagogue in every single town and village. That's what they did. They spent lots and lots of time, years, and money doing just that. So to make sure that this, not just this one, but many laws wouldn't be broken. The people had the option of going. Small villages with a few people still had synagogues, still had places to go to. They had a place they could stay with inside the town and not have to travel from place to place to place, or travel all the way to the temple every time that there's a Shabbat. They have within their own facility, their own area, their own place, they can dwell and worship and understand God. So they did this on purpose. It wasn't by just arbitrary, I feel like doing this. It was hey, let's build all these places so people can go somewhere and they can rest in Shabbat instead of traveling 15 or 20 or 30 miles by camel. Yes.
That 7 miles, that was on a Sabbath that they did that?
No. Point is, it probably would not have been, because Messiah would have made them break the Sabbath.
Okay. That was after his resurrection.
It was the same day.
The same day.
Yeah, same day.
He had lightning fast speed.
Yeah. Potentially, you could walk out on any of the remaining 6 days of the week. The Sabbath day journey, I believe, applied to most holy days also, but not necessarily all. But most. It was man-made, but it was still honored by him. A lot of things are man-made, still honored. Any questions or comments? Does that make sense? There's a lot of stuff in here. Just a ton of stuff. But stuff that affects other things. And how we see our lives, how we see ourselves, how we see life around us. Different tasks, they are applied. So each of the division of the inheritance means something different from person to person, from tribe to tribe. Well, I'm going to close with prayer because I'm out of time. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for this Shabbat, a day of rest. Help us, Father, to learn what is right and fair in your eyes, to do what is just and what is kind. Father, help us to follow whatever journey you take us on. We'll receive whatever you have in store for us in gifts and understandings and tasks to do. Grant us peace, Father, to listen to your voice, to not question you, to not rebel against you. And bless us, Father, as we learn your ways. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.